Please enjoy this previously recorded segment.
Welcome to the HR Power Hour, presented by Career Management Associates. I'm David Chulo. It's about all things in the human resource world. We're going to bring in local, regional, and national guests, and we're going to talk about a variety of topics and explain why human resource management is critical to your business success so that you can make decisions to keep and retain great talent.
Welcome to the HR Power Hour, presented by CMAcareer.com and Verrill-Law.com. I'm Tawny Alvarez, your host from Verrill, and today our guest is attorney Scott Maddox, CEO of Dirigo Safety, LLC, and we're discussing alcohol and drug impairment in the workplace. We're talking about the things that HR and company leaders need to keep at top of mind, from must-have trainings to identifying signs and symptoms of alcohol and drug impairment. Scott, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
I feel as though this topic is one that I deal with at least on a weekly basis. Thankfully, not on a daily basis. I'm going to leave dealing with it on a daily basis to you. But I find that so often I get a phone call from an employer, from an HR representative, and they give a whole set of facts, and then they hypothetically look into, well, maybe they're drinking, or maybe they're under drugs, or maybe it's just anxiety, or maybe it's depression. And I think that's something that you and I are going to talk a lot about today generally. But one of the things I find so interesting and helpful about the conversations that you and I have already have is your ability to provide employers with resources so that while making hypothetical determinations about what's causing a behavioral issue may not be in someone's best interest, at least you're giving them the tools to identify when that may be occurring. So, Scott, why don't you tell our listeners a little bit about yourself? Why am I asking you to talk about this subject?
Sure. Yeah. So, I'm the CEO of Dirigo Safety, and I'm an attorney by trade. And I have a career background in law enforcement. So I was involved in law enforcement for full-time for about 26 years. I was with a couple of small departments, police departments, including York, Maine and Cape Elizabeth. And then I went to Portland, Maine, where I was there for about 20 years. And I was a supervisor for the last 13. And one of the things that I did quite a lot of in Portland was investigation of impaired driving. And it's kind of a niche I fell into. One of the things that came up towards the latter part of my career was impairment by drugs, because, you know, the alcohol impairment is a fairly straightforward investigative process, but drug impairment tends to be more complicated. And there was some special training that is put on by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration. The investigation of drug impaired motorists. And in order to do that, you can become certified. If you're a police officer, you can become certified as a drug recognition expert. So I did that for a number of years, became an instructor in it. And then towards the end of my career in Portland, I went to law school. I don't know what possessed me to do that, but I was working midnight shifts and going to law school during the day and literally learning about constitutional law while applying constitutional law. So it was quite an interesting experience. In any event, when I left Portland, I became a hearings examiner for the Bureau of Motor Vehicles for that year. And then I worked a contract position with the Bureau of Highway Safety, teaching about impaired driving. You know, as a result, I had to go to nationwide conferences and study a lot of material. And you know, in addition to that, I probably, during my time in Portland, evaluated, you know, easily over 1,000 people for impaired driving. And so I got a real good experience of what it looks like applying out in the street. And also I got a real good educational background on it. So with that, I started this company, Dirigo Safety, in 2016, and thought, you know, there's a lot of need for this sort of training. Because there's really not anything available if you're not law enforcement, if you're just, you know, an HR or something like that. There's not a lot available, and develop this training class. And we cover a lot of interesting topics about impairment in the workplace.
Scott, I think one of the really neat things about what you're doing and what Derigo Safety offers more generally is the fact that you have this real world on the ground experience, that you're not somebody who's read a bunch of textbooks or who's going to talk to us about, you know, look for glossy eyes or see if you can smell, you know, alcohol in their breath or see if they can walk in a straight line. But you've truly seen how impairment can affect a multitude of individuals.
Yes.
Gender, size, age, kind of what the circumstance or situation is. And to me, that real world experience is so helpful because you and I both know that no situation is the same. There's no yep. situation where I believe you can say, oh, I've done this exact same thing in the past. Just like with HR, every situation's different.
Absolutely. Yes, human bodies are not all the same, and the human body doesn't react in the same way. There are some generalities that we can take into account with a variety of things, but you know, not everybody's going to react to certain drugs in the same way, and that makes it tricky when you're trying to, you know, look at the situation and see if there's impairment problem.
For those of you who are just joining us, you're listening to the HR Power Hour presented by CMAcareer.com and Verrill-Law.com. I'm your host, Tani Alvarez, and today our guest is attorney Scott Maddox, CEO of Derigo Safety, LLC. We're discussing alcohol and drug impairment in the workplace. Scott, so we talked a little bit about your creation of Derigo Safety after multiple career shifts from on the ground police work to DMV work with your law degree and the work that you did in that arena. Now, Derigo Safety offers a host of different types of trainings for companies and HR professionals and leadership generally. I would love for you to describe something that you advertise online called Mixed Cannabis and Alcohol Impairment Detection Lab. It's my understanding that it's the first in the country, but what is it?
So there has been one or two other classes that teach about, they call them green labs, that they teach about what somebody might present as if they're impaired by cannabis. But we're the first to do it to mix the alcohol equation. So essentially what this class is designed for is it's designed for law enforcement. Although we have had some conversations about developing a class for HR professionals, we haven't gone down that road yet. But what we do is we develop this class for law enforcement. And essentially we spend the day discussing a variety of best practices for investigating impaired driving. And then towards the end of the day, we present them with volunteers that have graciously ingested a variety of substances related to alcohol and or cannabis or a mixture of both. And then we try to use, you know, different types of volunteers that come from various backgrounds, some who may be experienced users with cannabis and some who may be brand new users with cannabis. And then we'll usually have somebody who's completely sober. And we might spill alcohol on them or blow some cannabis smoke in their face or something like that. And then we bring them out to the law enforcement officers who have just taken our training class. And we say, okay, tell us who's impaired and tell us what they're impaired by. And again, we have a couple of people that are maybe just drinking. We have one sober one. We have one or two people that are just using cannabis. And then they may use a different type of cannabis. For example, we might have somebody with edibles. We might have somebody who's vaping. We might have somebody using cannabis concentrate. And then we'll have a couple of people that are mixing. And we'll have a couple of people that are using just a little bit, like one beer and then maybe a couple of hits off the vape pen, just mixing them. And then we have the officers evaluate them. And once they make their decision about the sobriety of all of the people, we'll bring them back into a classroom. We'll set everybody up and we'll tell the officers exactly what their blood alcohol content is and how much cannabis they've smoked. And then we take and evaluate the consensus of the groups of officers as to whether or not they would arrest somebody for impairment. And it's very interesting. It's a great training, very much in demand. It can be complicated as heck to put on because, and I certainly don't mean to stereotype, but it's pretty difficult to find people who are consistently using cannabis all the time that want to come in and be exposed to a bunch of law enforcement officers to see whether or not they're impaired. So that's been tricky, but we've run, you know, probably about 20, 25 classes in several states, and it's been a real good experience for us.
That is super interesting. And I think probably also provides you with even further guidance as you're presenting and discussing all of these different best practices, I'd say, for companies and human resources professionals, especially since you're aware of what's being consumed and then also watching kind of how these individuals respond or behave based off of those activities. So in addition to that training that's more designed for law enforcement, you also offer two trainings that I believe are more focused for HR or companies. And the first one being a drug and alcohol impairment safety awareness course. Is that correct?
Yes. So yes, we have branched over into the HR arena. And one of the things that we've tried to do is make a class based on the federal guidelines of reasonable suspicion testing or reasonable cause testing. And incorporated into that class are just some general information and tips about drug and alcohol use and abuse. So as you probably are aware, you know, depending on the workplace safety plan and the policies that your workplace might have, if you're going to have testing in your place of employment, you know, you've got to have some people trained who are reasonable suspicion or reasonable cause testing standard. And the federal guidelines require an hour of alcohol training and an hour of drug training. And so we started doing that, and then we found out that really a lot of companies wanted more information. You know, and to talk about how alcohol affects someone in an hour is really a really tricky task. And drugs, again, in an hour, that's real tricky. There's literally, like, the drug recognition expert class that police officers take is about 2 weeks long just in the classroom. And then there's probably another 80 hours out in the street. So there's really a lot of information in there. And we also found that companies generally were concerned, you know, it's not only if someone's using drugs and alcohol in the workplace, but they were concerned about safety, obviously, but they're also concerned about their employee. So, you know, we were able to incorporate some more information about, you know, what the signs and symptoms of use and abuse would be with both drugs and alcohol and the trends. It's another thing that we talked about, I think you alluded to a little earlier, is, you know, it's not as easy as just, oh, hey, maybe this person might be using cannabis. You may or may not recognize that in their work performance, but also how might they be using it? I mean, there's just an impressive array of consumption methods out there, you know, for cannabis, for example. Everything from edibles to vape pens to, you know, concentrates to vaping concentrates to patches to creams. There's all kinds of ways to ingest cannabis. And I think that that sort of information is very helpful to HR specialists to be aware of. So that is our 4-hour class. And we spend about, 2 hours talking about alcohol, 2 hours talking about drugs. And we do focus on what you might see if someone is using, what you might see if someone is abusing. And then we also focus on, the way that these drugs are consumed and the trends that are occurring currently.
Thanks, Scott. I mean, there's a lot of information there, and I'm looking forward to this conversation for us to dig in a little bit more as to certain aspects of all the things that you just talked about. In the meantime, though, we're going to take a quick break. You're listening to the HR Power Hour on News Talk WLOB 100.5 FM and WLOBradio.com. We'll be right back.
In today's highly regulated climate, customized HR solutions are needed more than ever. Career Management Associates can partner with your existing HR department for projects or even serve as your outsourced HR team. From compliance and compensation to investigations and employer relations, CMA provides you trusted HR solutions. Call 207-780-1125 or visit cmacareer.com.
At over 150 years old, Verrill has an illustrious history with more than 7 generations of legal expertise. With more than 130 attorneys across 7 offices from Maine to Washington, D.C., Verrill serves clients across the country and around the world. HR professionals, business leaders, and in-house counsel count on Verrill as one of the premier labor and employment law practices in the Northeast. Contact Verrill at verrill-law.com. That's verrill-law.com.
And we're back, and you're listening to the HR Power Hour presented by cmacareer.com and verrill-law.com. I'm your host, Tawny Alvarez, and today our guest is attorney Scott Maddox, CEO of Dirgo Safety, LLC. And we're discussing alcohol and drug impairment in the workplace. We're talking about the things that HR professionals and company leaders need to keep at top of mind, from must-have trainings to identifying signs and symptoms of alcohol and drug impairment. Scott, prior to the break, you and I were discussing some of the trainings that your organization offers and kind of how extensive this is and the training that you've had and trying to get that into a smaller class that really helps supervisors and professionals identify really the most important stuff. And one of the things that you mentioned were trends and discussing trends. What would you say are some of the current trends that you're seeing related to drug and alcohol use?
Well, I think in a nutshell, 3 things come to mind. The first one being, I keep coming back to cannabis, but it's a big topic. And we have consulted with probably, I want to say, about 25 different workplaces, and every single one of them, that's the number one topic. I've got some employees that are using cannabis. How do I know? What can they do? What can't they do? I think that's the first topic, is that cannabis is extremely widespread. I'm only saying that anecdotally, but I'm in the middle of the HR training world for this. And not only is it widespread in its use, but it can be used in a number of different formats that many workplace supervisors or HR folks may not be up to speed on and familiar with. So there is the widespread use of cannabis and the use of cannabis in a format that many people are not aware of. And then alcohol too is in the last year, seems to be a more increase in this use. And, again, I can only speak anecdotally. I don't want to mistake correlation and causation, but, with the pandemic and everybody, the statistics that we're seeing for the number of alcohol use is rising. So that being said, there's also an increase in opiate use, and we've been contacted on a number of occasions. I can mention we've been contacted a lot more this year about that than we have before on opioid use. So cannabis, alcohol, and opioids tend to be the big three that are consistently a concern with workplace safety issues.
Yeah, it's interesting because I think a number of people felt or presumed that when the pandemic hit and when a large portion of the workforce went remote, that this may not or wasn't going to be as big of an issue as it was. Mm-hmm. In the same vein that people said, well, we're going to see a decrease in sexual harassment claims because nobody's going to be at the water cooler sexually harassing another person. I don't think that's really played out generally. And I think we're seeing, you know, generally an uprise in the mental health issues that employees are experiencing. And with that, questions, at least regarding drug and alcohol use and some of the gray areas between work time and non-work time, specifically for your exempt employees who maybe aren't punching a time clock day in and day out. Are there specific trends or aspects of the work that you do that you've come to recognize that HR leaders maybe aren't cognizant of or up to speed on as much as they should be?
Well, again, from my perspective, which, you know, of course is biased because people are calling us only when there's a problem, but, you know, how much use is currently going on in the workplace? And I think that, you know, as I said before, there's a number of, I could use the word concealment methods almost that people can use cannabis, for example, or alcohol, and HR leaders may not be cognizant of them. A couple of examples come to mind, liquid cannabis, or liquid THC, I should say, which is not actually cannabis at all. I mean, there's a product in Portland, Maine. I can't remember the brand here. It's pumpkin ale or something like that. That's actually a THC elixir, not an alcoholic drink. So, and depending on, and I think there's a question later on policy, but depending on how your workplace drug use policy defines a marijuana product, you know, that may or may not fall under the scope of your policy. So if your employee is using a THC elixir, number one, you may not be aware of it. They could be using it right there. It doesn't smell like THC. If we even know what THC smells like. And, it may not run afoul of the policy, but it's definitely intended to make you feel the effects. In fact, it's there was a newspaper article in the Portland Press Herald a month or two ago that where the company claims users will feel the effects of this elixir within 15 or 20 minutes. So there's things like that. There's of course edibles, and cannabis edibles come in every shape, size, basically anything that you could make can be made an edible. The vaping phenomenon, I'll call it, is also something that lends itself very easily to concealment because, you know, vape steam is not smoke, so you're not going to get that odor. You're not going to get the smoky odor that someone who's smoking in a room for a long time, you can smell it for days and days. You don't get that with a vape. And it can be exhaled in a way that, you know, someone would detect it. Plus, there's a number of vape devices that, you know, are surprising. You know, everybody knows about the vape cartridge that kind of looks like a USB drive, but there's all kinds of devices, you know, vapes integrated in cell phone, integrated in clothing. So there's all kinds of concealment uses of devices out there. So those are interesting trends that HR folks should be cognizant about. And other types of cannabis too, such as concentrate. And concentrate is a much more powerful or potent version of consuming cannabis that can get some people a lot more high than, you know, just regular flour or something like that. And the cannabis concentrate can be consumed in a number of different forms, including vape as well. So, you know, like somebody at work could be using a vape for nicotine cessation and actually replace the nicotine cartridge with a cannabis concentrate cartridge. And unless you tested it, you literally wouldn't be able to tell. And another product that's out there too is a powder. You know, there's dissolvable THC powders that can be put in, you know, a liquid, you pull in a spring water bottle and totally look legit, and your workers can be using it to get high. So that's out there. And I think I alluded earlier, a patch. You know, there's a lot of good cannabis patch products out there that you can see over the clothing. So the bottom line is this, HR leaders may not be cognizant of the fact that, you know, cannabis use can easily be completely undetected in the workplace, and being consumed, we would know that. So I think that's an important aspect to recognize.
Well, I feel like we're going to pile on because you just gave so much information about all the different ways in which specifically cannabis can be ingested. And one of the things you and I have talked about in the past is one of the other difficult aspects is the difference between marijuana and alcohol, and how even if you have a drug testing program, a positive screen for marijuana does not in fact indicate that a person is impaired. Can you explain why to our listeners?
All right, so I'll just back you up a sec and clarify. You said does not, I would say may not. So, but basically it works like this. And I apologize. I'm hoping there's no forensic toxicologists out there in the audience, but if there are, I apologize because I'm going to butcher the science here, and I'm not a scientist. That's my disclaimer. I'm just an attorney. And, from 5,000 feet, let's talk about it like this. Alcohol is a very well-known substance, and it has been studied legitimately for, you know, decades by scientists, so much so that scientists can tell from a level that a person has in their blood, scientists can tell whether or not that person is impaired, just without knowing anything else, just by knowing the level. And that's because of a number of things. It's the way the body metabolizes, it uses the alcohol, and it's the fact that it's been, you know, a legal drug since prohibition. It's been studied by science in many, many studies. And so we know a lot about it. Any other drug, we don't have them. Okay, any other drug that's impairing, psychoactive, we do not have that number. Now, since we've been talking a lot about cannabis, I'll stick with that number at the moment. And let me give you an example which will illustrate that. Let's say I'm a prosecutor and I am, making my closing arguments to the jury. And I say, you know, after the crash, the police officer took the defendant's blood and it was, 0.25. All right. Everybody in the jury is going to know immediately that person is him. So if we say, ladies and gentlemen, the jury, after the accident, the police officer took the blood and this person had 45 nanograms of THC in their blood, the jury's not going to really know what that means. And it's the same whether we're talking in a criminal trial or the same in the workplace, is that if you have a level of THC in your blood or in your urine, depending on how it's tested, it doesn't necessarily mean anything other than you've consumed something with THC in it recently. All right. And even recently is up for grabs, and that's a whole nother story. But basically the alcohol is consumed and it is distributed and it's eliminated in a predictable pattern, regardless of the person's psychophysical tolerance. Meaning, you know, we all know people who can drink one beer and they're falling over. And we all have that favorite uncle at Thanksgiving that can drink 10 beers and you never even know if the person has had a drink. But they're impaired regardless of the psychophysical presentation. And we know this from numerous scientific studies. Their judgment may be impaired. Their reaction time may be impaired. So we know that with alcohol. We don't know that with cannabis. So we don't know that, number one, because, of course, up until, what, 5-6 years ago, it's been illegal. So if it's illegal, well, actually, I should rephrase that. It still is illegal. All right. We have to remember that, however unlikely it is that, you know, the feds could come in any day and decide that means legalization, in quotes, is not really legal. So, but I digress. So getting back to the topic, we have not been able to study cannabis like we have alcohol. So we don't know, you know, how a person is affected. Well, I guess I should clarify that. We do know a lot about how a person is affected, but what we can't say, what scientists were, what these science has not come to a agreement upon is what levels of THC in someone's body cause them to be impaired in every circumstance. Some people are impaired at 45 nanograms. Some people are impaired at 15 nanograms. Some people are you know, running 5 nanograms and they haven't smoked in 2 weeks. So it's kind of all over the place. There are some generalities again, but in general, it is not specific enough to be able to, you know, support like we can with alcohol. At 1.5, we know this person is hammered. At an 0.8, we know this person is impaired. We don't have the same with cannabis, with THC, I should say. The other thing about THC, because let me back up a little bit. Cannabis has a couple of different cannabinoids in it. The most popular ones we know about, of course, are THC, which is the psychoactive impairing part. But there's also CBD, which is also very popular, a lot of people know about. That, from the best information we know, is not psychoactive. So, you know, you can have a number of nanograms, whatever number of CBD, and you're not going to be high. But with THC, there are some general guidelines, but the science is not agreement about, you know, we're not ready to make a black letter law that, hey, at, you know, 5 nanograms, everyone's in here. And the last thing I want to mention about that is the issue with elimination. So alcohol is, again, ingested in the body, distributed, and eliminated in a fairly predictable pattern. It's not the same with THC. So, for example, a novice user may, you know, utilize the THC in their body and metabolize it. It'll be gone in a certain amount of time. Maybe not so much with an experienced user. And that has to do with the way that the body utilizes the THC. It's not stored in the blood and excreted through the liver like alcohol is. It's stored in fat cells, so it can actually be in somebody's body for, you know, I've read research that says up to, you know, 20, 30 days. So somebody could have theoretically smoked 20 and 30 days ago, and then they would, you know, they would test positive for THC. It is a different kind of THC than if they had it active in their bloodstream. But nonetheless, I think the way to wrap this up is just what your question asked. A positive test does not indicate impairment. And even if the positive test did indicate recent use, we don't know what level people are impaired at well enough to be able to cause things such as putting them in jail or making them lose their job, you know, because it has to come from the observations of the person at the time.
Scott, I think all that is so helpful and such an important fundamental understanding for our listeners. We're going to take a quick break. You're listening to the HR Power Hour on News Talk WLOB 100.5 FM and WLOBradio.com. We'll be right back.
In today's highly regulated climate, customized HR solutions are needed more than ever. Career Management Associates can partner with your existing HR department for projects or even serve as your outsourced HR team. From compliance and compensation to investigations and employer relations, CMA provides you trusted HR solutions. Call 207-780-1125 or visit cmacareer.com.
Founded in 1958, Jackson Lewis is a national law firm with a local presence. The firm's 765 attorneys practicing in 54 locations throughout the U.S. and Puerto Rico provide a wide range of resources to address every aspect of the employer-employee relationship. HR professionals, business and in-house counsels, and C-suite professionals count on Jackson Lewis as it has one of the most active employee litigation practices in the United States. Contact them today at jacksonlewis.com. That's jacksonlewis.com.
And we're back, and you're listening to the HR Power Hour presented by CMAcareer.com and Verrill-Law.com. I'm your host, Tani Alvarez, and today our guest is attorney Scott Maddox, CEO of Dirgo Safety, LLC. And today we're discussing alcohol and drug impairment in the workplace. Prior to the break, we were talking about the fact that in some cases, you know, a positive screen for marijuana isn't, in fact, in all cases going to indicate that an individual is impaired. And Scott provided us some of the background on that. Scott, can you provide our listeners with some of the things that you would recommend that supervisors either are mindful of or cognizant of related to assessing whether or not an employee may be impaired? I mean, we just said the test in and of itself may not show impairment. Does that mean we're all up a creek without a paddle, or are there other things we can rely upon?
I guess what I would recommend is that your supervisors and HR folks at your workplaces don't try to assess whether or not somebody's impaired, because I think that is an area in, and again, disclaimer out there, I'm not an employment law specialist, but I think that's an area in employment law that is ripe for problems. And here's what I mean. I think that you're better off being as objective as possible and simply not trying to diagnose impairment in the workplace, but measuring workplace performance. Because when you, first of all, no HR person, all due respect, or supervisor in the workplace is going to be an expert in the area of diagnosing impairment. I think it's a mistake to say, it's definitely a mistake to say, hey, employee Z is drunk. They're an alcoholic. We don't want to deal with them in the workplace. We need to punish them or whatever. We don't want to say that. Instead, what we want to do is remain objective. And what you should be cognizant of is measuring workplace performance. So employee A comes in and, you know, they're making 10 widgets a day, not to take us back to law school, but they're making 10 widgets a day. And then all of a sudden, you know, they're making like 2 widgets a week. What's up with that? Now, in the carrying out the HR task or the supervisor's task of trying to assess workplace performance, we happen to come across a fifth of vodka in their, you know, desk, or some vape pens, because we took the Ergo Safety's class on identifying drug trends. We know what this vape pen looks like. Then we can include that objectively in the report. And we're going to say, hey, listen, I'm not a drug recognition expert or a toxicologist or anything, but, you know, employee A is only making 2 widgets and he's a little unsteady when he's walking around and, you know, on his desk met this and this. And then we're going to take our standardized objective form and we're going to jot all that down and we're going to package it up all nice and neat. We're going to send it up to HR and, you know, the board of directors or whoever it is up top, because that's what they get paid for. And maybe we'll even bring the case to some sort of, you know, corporate law specialist like yourself and be able to make an informed decision. But that's my take there is be mindful of that. You're not a drug recognition expert. You're not a forensic toxicologist. you certainly don't want to label people with drug impairment or alcohol impairment or anything that could be even close to ADA related and call it that in the workplace. Judge people by what are they supposed to do? Are they doing that? And take it.
I tell you what, Scott, I'm always excited when a guest gives the advice that I would give as well. So I agree. Let's not focus on the why, but the what. In addition to that, and I think it leads to my next question. Let's talk a little bit about if you were going to give us three items that good HR policies related to impairment should include. Are there any elements within an impairment policy that you would want to see a company include?
Yeah, absolutely. I think if I were working on policies for workplace impairment, the first thing I would do is make sure that I have a good definition of impairment. So what exactly are we talking about here? Do we have to have an employee who can't walk a straight line or can't bend over to tie their shoes? I mean, that's historically a common layperson idea of impairment. But really, impairment needs to include not only the physical manifestations of it, but it also has to include the employees entrusted with, making solid judgment calls and they're not, reaction time, things of that nature. So impairment, and it's got to be tied to workplace performance too. I think that, your impairment is interfering with the work. Because theoretically, somebody could be consuming an impairing substance and not be impaired. Cannabis edibles is a good example that comes into mind. The onset time for those, for example, and this is something we would teach in the trends class, is up to 2 hours. So somebody could, take a late afternoon break and have, the latest yummy cannabis gummy bears, and they could go back to work for, an hour or two and not even feel the effects. So theoretically they're using it in the workplace, but they're not impaired. So does that really count? I really would be careful and rethink, have we adequately defined impairment? The other thing I think is important to define is a cannabis or marijuana product. There are liquids with THC, THC infused elixirs. There are powders. It's a THC patch, a marijuana product, speaking from personal experience, we've used some of those patches in our green lab classes for police officers. And, they can produce a pretty strong buzz in some people that are cannabis naive. And, is that a marijuana product? If it's not listed as a marijuana product in your policy, and someone's using that, can you discipline them if they're impaired in the workplace? Probably can for the impairment, but it's not going to be something that you're expected to see. So given all the new trends and the ways that things are done in that world, I would want to, pay attention to my definitions in my policy section to make sure they're up. The other thing, and I alluded to one before, and a lot of companies do have something like this, but I would want to reiterate that we have a standard objective reporting. So make it easier and stronger for your supervisor that's reporting this. And don't have a form that requires them to put down a lot of open-ended observations, I think, because people just naturally are going to be conclusionary in their observations. Instead of John was drunk, so I came up. We don't want to do that. We want a checklist that says, did they have bloodshot eyes? Did you smell intoxicants? Were they on study on their feet? And have them have maybe a list of check boxes they can check off or whatever. But the more objective we can make it, the more standardized so that every employee is being evaluated with the same form, that's a really important part of the policy. The last one, I think that it seems intuitive, but I see it missing quite a bit, is should we encounter an impaired person somewhere in our workplace, we need to make sure that we get them wherever they need to go safely. And these observations that we're making shouldn't be one-on-one observations. So in other words, don't send the impaired person, down the street to go to the HR building and then have them get in their car and drive down there and then sit in the office with the HR person alone while the HR person's making all his observations. That's obviously an extreme example. But my point being, make sure that your policy indicates this person's going to be transported by other employees wherever they need to go to be safe. And if they refuse to, and they demand that they want to drive off on their own, make sure that we're going to call the police, because we don't want to allow someone we think is impaired driving off from our company ground and crash and kill a family of five. So we're going to be careful with that. And then always supervisors or HR persons who are going to be talking to this person, evaluating this person, don't do it alone. Have one-on-one, or excuse me, two-on-one observations. So those are three important things I want to make sure we're doing policies.
Those are really important and great points, Scott. And I think some of them are ones that people who aren't working or operating in this area kind of day in and day out wouldn't think to either dig in on, or it wouldn't be until the moment occurred where they'd say, wait, should I be doing X, Y, and Z instead of having a pre-described kind of avenue set forth before the problem happens? We're going to take a quick break. You're listening to the HR Power Hour on News Talk WLOB 100.5 FM and WLOBradio.com. We'll be right back.
Founded in 1958, Jackson Lewis is a national law firm with a local presence. The firm's 765 attorneys practicing in 54 locations throughout the U.S. and Puerto Rico provide a wide range of resources to address every aspect of the employer-employee relationship. HR professionals, business and in-house counsels, and C-suite professionals count on Jackson Lewis, as it has one of the most active employee litigation practices in the United States. Contact them today at jacksonlewis.com. That's jacksonlewis.com.
And we're back, and you're listening to the HR Power Hour, presented by CMA, Career.com, and Verrill-Lott.com. I'm your host, Tawny Alvarez, and today our guest is attorney Scott Maddox, CEO of Dergo Safety, LLC. And today we've been discussing alcohol and drug impairment in the workplace. We've been talking about the things that HR leaders and other leaders need to keep at top of mind, from must-have trainings to identifying signs and symptoms of alcohol and drug impairment. Scott, I'd love to end our time together with a hypothetical. So let's say, and you and I are both attorneys, so we live for hypotheticals.
Yes, we do.
Let's say that I am a shift supervisor at the widget company. And I am at the widget company and I see somebody, my employee, Bob, and I swear Bob is under the influence. I can't tell if he's under the influence of alcohol or drugs. What's the first thing that I do?
Well, is Bob the widget manufacturer in a safety sensitive position?
Let's say Bob is, and that's one of the things that I'm nervous about, is he drives the forklift, he moves the widgets from point A to point B, and he's slurring a little bit, and he doesn't seem all there.
Well, so in those sorts of situations, we'll preface everything by saying we're going to follow a company policy. So obviously, you know your company policy and you've been trained on it and you've signed off on it and you're going to follow that. So, you know, in the interest of time, there's a million different kind of companies out there. There's a million different kind of policies out there. So I'm not exactly sure how we'll do it step by step, but there are some big takeaways from this. The first thing we have to do is make sure Bob is safe. So, you know, we're going to have to get a supervisor over there or get another supervisor over there. We're going to have to comfortably and casually, you know, take Bob to a safe place and make sure that the forklift is turned off and in a safe condition. Because, you know, as we all know, it's always safety first. And then, you know, in talking to Bob, we have to, of course, follow policy, and we have to, of course, be, you know, cognizant of all the problematic areas of the ADA and that. But we essentially want to make sure Bob's okay. Are you okay? What's happening, Bob? I notice you kind of were a little shaky over there on the forklift. Why? You know, and there's nothing wrong with asking open-ended questions like that and letting Bob, you know, basically tell us what he's going to tell us. And you know, not because we're looking to jam him up on any sort of workplace safety thing, but because we're really concerned about Bob's well-being. And we want to make sure he's safe and everybody else is safe. And, you know, depending on what Bob says, we're going to take it a number of different ways. The other thing that we want to do is make objective observations. And by objective observations, and you know, we're gonna look around the area. I want to take a look in the forklift. You know, do we see a fifth of vodka on the forklift, you know, control panel? Then that's something that's, you know, really important for this workplace to document. And, you know, maybe we even take a picture of it. Maybe we take a, you know, according to our policy, maybe we take a picture of Bob. It depends on what you've got going on in your workplace. But the important takeaway is to make Bob safe, take Bob somewhere, you know, not alone, and we don't let Bob have the wheel, but we take Bob someplace where, you know, he can have dignity and privacy, and yet we can talk about what's going on, and then we don't want to document everything objectively. And then if we have, you know, depending again, of course, on our workplace and our policy, if we have that reasonable cause testing, which, you know, if you had a drug and alcohol-free workplace, by there's no doubt you'd have that reasonable cause at this point, send them for testing.
Scott, thank you so much for your time today. I have found this session to be so helpful, both from an understanding some of the trends that you're seeing, as well as just general best practices as it relates to impairing substances in the workplace. So thank you so much for your time.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
You've been listening to the HR Power Hour on News Talk WLOB 100.5 FM and WLOBradio.com.
Thank you, everyone, for listening, and catch us every week at 10 a.m. on News Talk WLOB 100.5 FM or 1310 a.m. and streaming live at WLOBradio.com. Podcasts of this show and every show are available at HRPowerHour.com. Have a great week, everyone, and remember, HR management is critical to your business's success.